Hello, and welcome to Choosing Life Over Pain. Today, we're talking to Emmanuel Tambakakis. Emmanuel, hi. Welcome, and would you like to introduce yourself a little bit?
Hi. Sure. My name is Emmanuel. I was trying to think of something to say to introduce myself, but I couldn't think of anything cool and witty. So I'll just say hi. I'm Emmanuel, and that's it.
Well, you know, Emmanuel Tambakakis is a beautiful, beautiful name. Tell me something about your name.
It's really weird. I didn't pick it. Somehow, I've always been called that.
No way.
Yeah. I know. I think my parents picked it. Otherwise, I don't know. Like, I've been trying to find, like, the manufacturer's label. And I've never been able to find that. So there's no, copyright. There's no, I couldn't find the, what do you call it? The rebate papers, you know, that have, you know,
right,
the model number.
Right.
So, you know, so I've always been called Emmanuel Tambakakis. I've worked in news my whole life. And so in news, everything, I've worked in TV news and, you know, it's always, everything has to be fast. So if saying my name is too long, Emmanuel. So I've always been called E.T. When I worked in Phoenix, a reporter I worked with, who's the best reporter I've ever worked with, his name is Lou Ruggiero. He's since retired, but he was the best, and he would get on the intercom at the station, and whenever he was ready for me to come to his desk to talk about the story or to come get the videotape to edit and the script, he would get on the intercom and say, E.T., phone home. And, you know, I knew it was my turn to go to his desk and check in with him.
Right.
My best friends and a few other people call me E-Man. And then I go, so the Greek, I'm half Greek, half Armenian, and my first name is very common in Greece, and the nickname for that, especially Crete, where my family is from, and the nickname for Emmanuel is Manoli. Not Manny, because people in New York turn it into Manny, and I just, you know, I don't wear a pinky ring. I don't wear a wife beater with a gold necklace, you know, so I'm not a Manny.
Okay,
But Manoli is the name that my family calls me.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Manoli, yes.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. From Crete. Wow. It's a beautiful name, Emmanuel. And Manoli.
It's also biblical because everybody who I ever meet who knows anything about religion is like, oh, especially even like in Judaism, they're like, oh, you know what Emmanuel means, right? And I'm like, yes, I know. It means God is with us. You know, so I've heard that about a million and a half times, but that's what apparently Emmanuel means.
Right, right.
There's also a Christmas song that, you know, that they named after me, or Jesus. I can't remember which one. It's either me or Jesus. But,
yeah,
you know,
there is. That's right.
Come Emmanuel or something like that. And I'm like, all right, where am I supposed to go? And they're like, come on, Emmanuel. And I'm like, all right.
Where am I supposed to go? I don't know. Maybe you're supposed to know. I don't know. The songs are named after you. I don't know. It's a beautiful song, though.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
It's a nice ring to it.
Beautiful song, beautiful name. Very historic. So speaking of stories, why don't you tell us a little bit about your story of how you came to have a brain injury?
I've been a television news photojournalist my entire career. And in 2009, I was on an assignment. I used to work for CNN. And I was on an island in Greece called Ikaria. I think it's how you say it in English. It's I-K-A-R-I-A. R-I-A. I know how to say it in Greek.
How do you say
Ikaria?
Greek is good. Ikaria.
Yeah, Ikaria. I believe it's named after the Greek mythological figure of Icarus, which is kind of funny how it kind of plays into the story because I was there doing a shoot on longevity, and I really tested it out. I was throwing cable down to the beach from a cliff on the very last day of the first week that we were there doing the shooting for CNN. We were getting prepared to do our last live talk back to the Anderson Cooper show. And I climbed halfway down this cliff and I threw the cable down to the bottom of the cliff where I was going to connect the camera to the live shot, because at the bottom of the cliff were these hot springs at the edge of the ocean that people would soak, like, arthritic limbs and whatnot.
Right.
Two days prior to this, one of the aspects of the longevity that we were looking at there, and it was through this the reporter's name was Dan Buettner. He's not a CNN person, but he goes around the world finding these places called blue zones. He's been on Oprah mm-hmm. and all this other stuff, and he's written some really cool books on the material. But mm-hmm. one of the aspects that we were looking at in longevity, or that he was looking at, was on the island, the honey is very potent. Because the island is developed, it's got electricity and water and all that stuff, but it's not overly developed. So the bees have their pick of all the wildflowers on the whole island to make their honey, and so the honey is this really awesome, full of nutrients and rich different things because of all the different flowers and things that they get their pollen from.
Mm-hmm.
So when we did that part of the story 2 days prior, there was only one bee suit. So, of course, the guy who's in front of the camera, I made sure he had it, because if you have him in front of the camera and he's saying, ouch, crap, expletive, it's
right,
not really good for TV.
Yeah, right.
The camera guy, on the other hand, me, I got stung probably about 40 times.
Oh, no. Well, you're not allergic, I hope.
I'm not allergic. Otherwise, I would have been probably dead. I was on, all kinds of, like Benadryl type stuff. And also I went to the pharmacy there because I'm Greek and I speak Greek, and I went to the pharmacy and I told the pharmacist, that the bees of the island raped me, and what could he give me? And because in Greece, they can dispense, medicines that are prescription strength medicines over the counter.
Oh, okay.
So mm-hmm. he gave me three medicines and told me, what dosage to take. Mm-hmm. So I was doing that. And then so Dan told me that the morning of my accident, or the day of my accident, that we were, we needed to do the live shot. And he said, listen, let's just do it here from where we're staying. You can see the ocean. And it's pretty, he said that I was very insistent on going to the location where we had shot the video earlier in the week of the hot springs at the edge of the ocean. And mm-hmm. and I know he's telling the truth, because that's the kind of person that I am. I feel like mm-hmm. that's how I feel a little bit partially responsible for, I feel responsible for my accident, because had I not been so forceful, we would have done it in the parking lot of where we were staying,
Right.
It would have been done, and I would have, it would have been a significantly different life I've had the last, 8 or 9 years.
But right.
He said that you were like, no, let's go. So we go to the roadside where, overlooking where the cliff was, and he said, okay, let's just set up here and do it. And, our freelance satellite guy is setting up all the stuff, and he said you were like adamant that you needed to go down to the bottom where the steam was that we could see it in a live shot. And I was like, yep.
Would have been
like
a better shot. It would have been a better shot, right?
Yeah. Sure. And that's the kind of person I am. And I was like, yep, that sounds like me. And so mm-hmm. I guess I climbed halfway down. And he told me I was feeling a little bit, woozy that day. I have very little to no recollection of that day, except for like 3 microsecond slivers of that day of memories. Yeah. But he said I had complained about feeling woozy, and so I climbed halfway down the cliff, threw the cable down, and then I looked up at them on the top of the cliff, and I fell off backwards about 2 or 3 stories onto some rocks that used to be a staircase that was it was like broken concrete and rebar. That was a staircase that had the land underneath had eroded, so it kind of crumbled and fell apart. And so that's what I landed on.
Yep. Oh my Lord.
So that's the accident.
Yep. And so, and what's the next thing you remember?
The next thing I remember, from that day, I remember the little slivers I remember. I remember speaking to my sister, Tina, who lives, she lives in LA, but she was visiting New York because I was in Greece on this 2-week long shoot. and mm-hmm. my now ex-wife was at a writer's conference here in New York City. So my sister mm-hmm. had come in because just to spend time with, you know, her niece, my daughter. Mm-hmm. And so I remember speaking to my sister that day because I remember she and my daughter were at the park. And I remember her telling me that. That's one little sliver. Mm-hmm. And then the other little sliver was I remember the getting the satellite guy situated at the location where I fell. I remember, like, just briefly.
Mm-hmm.
I was conscious when I fell, which I have probably revisited a million times in my, you know, in my dreams, because I was diagnosed with PTSD from that.
Sure.
And I have these weird, like, visions, I think when I'm asleep or sometimes of the actual, you know, like, the impact.
So your sort of body and your subconscious remember it, but you don't really consciously remember it. Is that
yeah, it's not
fair
super
to say?
Clear. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. In my accident, when my husband and I were hit by a car, mm-hmm. I had a flash of seeing light because it was at night, and flashed like the most slivery kind of memory of saying we're going to get hit, but don't remember anything. But there is something in my body that sort of feels like there is some sort of movement of getting hit that, you know, I don't really know what it is, but there's something there that, so I can kind of relate to what you're saying about, mm-hmm. you sort of know it's there and yeah, but so I'm with you in understanding. Please continue.
So, my family lives in Greece. My dad and everybody, stepmom, and I have a half sister. They live on the island of Crete. And then I have an aunt and uncle and cousins who live in Athens.
Mm-hmm.
So the island where I fell does not have a hospital. It has a little clinic.
Mm-hmm.
I know it has a clinic because when I got stung by the 40 bees, I was taken to the clinic. And they gave me a giant shot in my butt, I guess to counteract all the bee stuff. But
right.
But I was told that I was taken there.
Right.
They had no ability to handle what had happened to me. I was told I was comatose.
Uh-huh.
And then, so the CNN, you know, pulled some strings and yelled at some people, and the Greek Air Force, I don't know exactly how long, but it was 8 or 12 hours later, flew in a twin engine, military plane, like a cargo plane, and they loaded me up and flew me to Athens.
Wow.
And then straight into an ambulance and straight to the hospital and straight into, you know, surgery.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to interrupt quickly to show you back to your reference of the name of the island.
The island part, yeah. So Icarus, you know, if you remember your mythology, Icarus, you know, flew too close to the sun and his wings melted and he crashed. And I think that was the end of Icarus, wasn't it?
Yes. Luckily this wasn't your end.
Yeah, I mean, well,
they
you know,
saved
otherwise
you.
I could have had an island named after me. That would have been pretty cool.
That would have been E.T. Island, right?
E.T. Island.
E.T. Island. But this way, you fell before you actually were flying, and they flew you out to safety.
Yeah, they flew me to Athens, and then 2 weeks later, I remember waking up and hearing somebody say, oh, there he is. And then I opened my eyes, and there's my family, my now ex-wife, my daughter, my sister, my dad, my stepmom, my aunt and uncle. They were all lined up in chairs in this room. And I'm like, I just said, why are you all here, and where is here?
What are you guys doing here? But how amazing to have your family there. That's amazing.
That was a bit of luck.
Well, I don't know if it's luck, because they made an effort to get there for you, I think.
Well, I mean, it could have happened when I was in Iraq, you know, then good luck, you know, anybody getting there.
Right.
You know,
indeed.
So, but it was in Greece, and
indeed.
I had family there, and my family in Athens, you know, was able to basically just drive to the hospital.
Yeah, oh, that's great. That's fantastic.
It's important because it's in Greece, the way it's all public medicine, And if it's not like here in the States where the, you know, they wait, that the nursing staff kind of take care of you very, very closely. In Greece, that's your family's job. The nursing staff only comes to administer, you know, medicine or take, you know, pulses or whatever they need to do, but that's it. They're not there coddling you like they do here in the States. So, so my family was there for me.
Yeah. That's fantastic. They were. It's fascinating the difference in structure, and operational structure of the medical system. And so wonderful that your family could be there for you.
Yeah, it was funny because CNN had, you know, there was a producer who I used to work with at CNN. She was on Anderson Cooper's show. She's Greek American, and they flew her out immediately to Athens. They flew my sister, my now ex-wife, and my daughter from New York to Greece because my prognosis was that I was going to die. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty serious. And they flew this producer from the Anderson Cooper show named Penny Manis. She's a really nice person, super sweet and Greek American. So she's, you know, cool in my book. Yeah. So CNN, probably from her prompting, had arranged, instead of a public hospital, had arranged for a private hospital. Because if you have money in Greece, you know, you don't do the public thing where you can wait forever and, you know, to get stuff done. It eventually gets done, I guess, but you just have to, you know, it's first come, first serve, I guess, and who you know. But CNN had a whole, like, surgery or operations theater, you know, set up in this private hospital. They were waiting for me to, you know, to get in. And one of the people who was on Dan's team, you know, from you know, doing a shoot on the islands, she's Greek American. She's actually an MD, but she's more on the policy side than the practice side.
Mm-hmm.
So she came with me in the military flight to Athens, and she was telling them, listen, you know, this is where we're going to go. This is the hospital, you know, that it's has been set up. They're waiting for him. And the Greek authorities are like, yeah, we're going to do what we want, and we're taking him to the public hospital. And you can't really say anything.
Oh, wow.
Which is fine, you know, because, I mean, and that's also, it's funny because the Greeks are pretty hard-headed, you know.
Yeah.
Luckily, I'm not as hard-headed as I thought I was because it's what saved my life. The fact that my head broke in so many places allowed my brain to expand, you know, and not collide in on itself. We're like Liam Neeson's wife. She banged her head skiing, but she didn't have any, I don't know. I don't think she had a concussion or anything like that, but she didn't have anywhere for her brain to go, you know, as it got swollen and it killed her.
Yeah.
It was my head. I broke it in so many places. It was like, oh, here, let's make some space. You know, let's let the brain, you know, grow.
Expand and swell. Yeah. And if it needed to bleed, it could bleed out. Right. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Interesting. That's an interesting point. Right. Yeah. How long were you in Greece in the hospital?
I was in a coma for a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I was awake for a few days after that I have no recollection of.
Yeah.
And then I was cognizant and then from when I was cognizant, I don't know how much longer I was there, maybe another week or week and a half.
Yeah.
I wish, you know, my family wanted me to stay in Greece to, you know, to get the rest of my medical care because it was really good there. My now ex-wife said, no, we're taking him back to New York, which, you know, I didn't realize, you know, I wasn't a party to that, all that, you know, probably arguing, I probably would have, they probably would have repaired my hearing enough in Greece to where I wouldn't have lost my hearing. Cause when I fell, I landed on my skull and it shattered my skull broke and it shattered all the bones in my left ear.
Yeah.
And I've had three surgeries on it, but it wasn't reparable.
Right.
But anyway, so like probably a week or week and a half after, CNN wanted to fly me and my sister and my ex-wife and my daughter back commercially, but the Greek neurosurgeon, to his credit, you know, he said, listen, he's not leaving here unless I see a manifest that they're flying back medically.
Right.
I don't know if it was, I don't know how necessary it was. I mean, cause you know, I was freshly, you know, injured, so I don't know how medically necessary it was, or if he was just trying to stick it to CNN. I don't know what his interactions were with them, but you know, it was great.
Knows?
Yeah, because we had a
he was really trying to protect
plane.
You.
Yeah.
Wow.
We had our own plane flying back. There was a doctor on and a nurse on there, and they had, I was on a, like a, like a, what do you call it, like a hospital bed in the plane.
Wow.
We landed.
That's
crazy.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, I remember all that. Yeah,
what did it feel like to be like on a hospital bed on a plane? Could you tell? What did that feel like?
I mean, it was kind of, I was like, it didn't seem, I guess I was so still kind of like, freshly injured that it didn't seem weird. Cause I was still fresh, but, I remember it being nice. You know, I mean, it wasn't luxuriant or anything, but we flew from Athens to Iceland, and then we landed there and we refueled.
Yep.
And then we flew from Iceland to New York. Or actually to Teterboro, to New Jersey, where we were met by an ambulance. An ambulance took me to Columbia Presbyterian for a couple days because there wasn't a bed available in Mount Sinai's head injury unit. And then from there, I went to Mount Sinai's head injury unit.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I can imagine this after my ex and I was in sort of this lovely kind of peaceful, never land. And that could have been, the drugs they had me on or whatever, but, it could have been for the, they might have for the flight, but that's great. I'm glad the trip was nice.
I went back, to Greece. I was still kind of not working full time just yet, but I went back to Greece, a year after the accident, to go back to the island where I fell, and I went back to the exact place where I fell.
How was that?
To try to make peace with it, because everything after my accident was a bit rough. CNN was being really weird with me. My ex had abandoned me. So things were really tough.
Was she your ex at the time, or was she your ex at the time, or was she? Yeah. Later.
No, well, I mean, the relationship had fallen apart, and I had I moved out of my apartment with her and my daughter. Not before she was pregnant with our son. She wanted to have another kid, and after that, she was done with me. But I flew back and just to try to make peace, because I was a wreck, emotionally.
Right.
I was a total wreck. I went back to the island, and and all the people were so happy to see me, and because I made some really good friends, like especially with a woman and her family that ran the place we were staying. It's like a little, a little hotel, but it's more like a pension, whatever you call it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because I went back when I was trying to find the place that I fell. I had a rental car, and I was driving over there, and I wasn't exactly sure, and I saw these two. People in Icaria walk around. I think that's why they live so long. But I saw this, it was like a group of older women doing some kind of like, walker size or jazzercise or something like that. And I, I asked them, I said, hey, is this the place where the camera guy fell last year?
Mm.
And they were like, oh yeah, that's where he died.
Oh and my God.
I said, actually, he didn't die. And they're like, what are you talking about? Everybody knows, he died over there.
Yeah.
And I said, actually, well, I'm the camera guy. And they like stepped back like they had just seen a ghost. And they're like, what?
Oh my, yeah.
And that was interesting. Then Greeks are very emotional people. And they were so happy. They're like, oh my God, that's so great. I'm so glad you're okay.
Oh, that's fantastic. Oh, what a wonderful scene and a wonderful thing to share with them and just to experience, their joy in knowing that you're alive. How did you feel?
It's interesting because, for the immediate time, I don't remember exactly how I felt then, but I wasn't happy to be alive for a long time. I was mad that I didn't die. So it was interesting at that point.
Yeah.
My accident was a bad day at work. Everything else after that was way worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, my ex abandoning me at the most critical time in my life that I needed somebody there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was tough.
Yeah.
Oh, and then on the way, so you can't go to the island without having to go through Athens.
Mm-hmm.
So I went through Athens and, I went to the hospital where I was, had the surgery and everything like that. And I went to the neurosurgeon and had coffee with him and, you know, thanked him for saving my life.
Oh, that's fantastic. So I imagine that was do you remember how you felt in that moment?
It's weird looking at somebody you know had that directly saved your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's really weird. You look at your parents, I guess, you know, in a certain way because they brought you to life, but
mm-hmm.
it's really weird coming face to face with somebody who, you know, sawed open your skull and went in there and repaired the damage and then put you back together and
mm-hmm.
made you live. It's, it's hard to explain in words, but, he was
mm-hmm.
happy to see me, was curious
mm-hmm.
about, you know, how everything was going. And I explained to him,
mm-hmm.
you know, everything that I was dealing with and he was empathetic, you know, to that. Or sympathetic,
mm-hmm.
over whichever word it is. But, yeah, all in all, it was good to go. And I felt like I had to do that. Like I needed to thank him,
mm-hmm.
you know, versus just,
yeah.
you know, a phone call or an email. Like, yeah, I can't imagine sending out an email saying, hey, you know, thanks for saying, hope all is well. Bye.
You know? Right. Yeah. It seems a little trite.
Yeah.
Especially if you're, you know, somewhat conflicted in how you're feeling, you know, about the whole, you know, all the outcomes to go.
I never thought any ill of him by thinking, God, if this guy wasn't so good, you know, I could have died, you know, but
mm-hmm.
I turned it more into like a bigger thing because, I mean, I was baptized as a kid and whatnot, but I turned it into like a thing about like, you know, God. And I thought, wow, you know what? If there was a God, then that God would have let me pass away. And I was really mad
mm-hmm.
at that. So then I just like, yeah, I'm done with this. I'm not going to even pretend, you know, I'm done with it. Cause I jumped
You're
into Buddhism
with
Christianity, with God and all that.
Yeah.
I was always very skeptical, but I was just like, all right, this is, to me, this is my evidence. And so, I had a huge spiritual hole in my heart, you know, when I'm like living on my couch in my own house, you know, after it was clear, you know, where things were going with me and my ex. So I just, you know, went online and looked up, you know, Buddhism, New York City, because it was the only thing that ever really spoke to me, like spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
So I jumped into Buddhism head first and I don't want to say like it saved me, like in a sense, like there are these Christian people that are like, oh, you know, I was saved by the Lord, but
it would
have been a very, it was a very solid, you know, foundation for me to lean on, throughout the whole thing.
So, I think this is an interesting sort of segue, and I don't want to be pedantic about, you know, the sort of name of this podcast, right? Choosing Life Over Pain, nor literal necessarily, but it sounds to me like, you know, there's a lot of very difficult issues, you know, given the results of the injuries that you have and the emotional issues that you've had to go through since the accident. You found something that has helped you. So for me, that's somewhat the essence of what I see as sort of choosing life over pain you tell me that if I'm crazy. But for me, like finding something like Buddhism is
mm-hmm.
somewhat like, you know, it is choosing life over pain. That's a way of finding a path. And does that make some sense to you, or how do you hear choosing life over pain?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Buddhism part was definitely the choosing the life over the pain. You know, people will argue that Buddhism is not a religion; it's a philosophy, or it is a religion and a philosophy. Whatever. I don't care. I mean, I'm not going to. I don't care about the semantics. But
right.
I'll tell you, Buddhism to me, I mean, it's like a 22,600, so however old it is, you know, like philosophy on psychology. And it's about, to me, Buddhism is about getting your head out of your ass and how to help other people do the same. And I'll tell you, you know, after my accident and all the depression and all the stuff that I dealt with, my head was way up my ass. And Buddhism is like this gentle friend saying, hey, listen, you know, here's why we think your head is up your ass. Here's some steps that you can take to pull your own head out of your ass, which is really good because you're not praying to, you know, like a saint or a this or a that. It's like, no. If you want to know who's going to help save you, go look in the mirror. And that can be tough sometimes because you're like, wow, I don't feel like saving me. But you know what?
Right.
Ultimately, it's your responsibility. And that's why I like Buddhism, because it's just like gentle way of saying, listen, here, you know, you can, if you want, you can keep your head up your ass and you're just going to continue to suffer, you know, and other people will suffer the same because their heads are up their ass. But if you can find a way to steer clear of, you know, that and see the world for what it is, and you can help other people do that, then it's great. It's like a motivational thing to not only help for you to help yourself, but it makes you think of the greater whole of everybody. So it's this motivation. It's this incentive to, you know, get clear of your own crap and help other people. And helping other people is something that brings me a lot of joy. I feel like I help other people better than I help myself. But
yeah, that's a great theme.
Yeah. But, you know, ultimately, I have to help myself, you know.
Yeah.
And then I'll even be at a greater capacity to help other people. But
yeah.
Buddhism, you know, and it's funny because, when, you know, a lot of the teachings in Buddhism, they're like, are along the lines of, you have this precious life. Don't waste it. Like, you know, it's here and now. Don't make plans down the road to take care of, you know, getting your head out of your butt. Start doing it now.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I'm very much a person of, like, you know, I've always been very much like, all right, right now, right here, right now. And that's what it's really helped me out, because there's a lot of times when I, you know, I want to, like, cue the violin, you know, at my own little pity party. And you know, there's a lot of things that I've read and teachings that I've read that are like, well, you know, that's, you know, the violins are nice, and, you know, you sobbing is, you know, I guess a good accompaniment to the violins, but, you know, where's it getting you?
So that's a good point for a question. What was the catalyst to make you do that Google search on Buddhism? Was there one thing? Was it a combination of things that led you to that?
I just, you know, I had my work computer, my laptop from CNN, know, that I would just always had with me. And I was, you know, basically living on my couch, and I just felt this, like, it felt like a pothole in my chest. I knew that, like, going forward, I couldn't just, you know, gloss it over and say, oh, whatever, I'll just, you know, I'll do something to self-medicate, you know, which is, I don't do that. I mean, the woman who raised me was an alcoholic, and is to this day, as far as I know. I didn't see any other way, you know, because it's not something that I could gloss over. It'd be like putting a piece of tissue over a 2 foot deep pothole in the street. It's not gonna do anything. So I knew I had to address it, and I knew it was coming from a place of spirituality, because it was too deep of a hole to just, you know, like, do shopping therapy or, you know, whatever, to fill.
Yep.
So I just was like, all right, you know, time to man up and, you know, take responsibility here. And so I Googled, you know, Buddhism, New York City. And it, one of the things that came up was Tibet House. And it showed that there was like, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday nights, just, you know, they called it just open meditation. And there were classes, and I started going to them, and I'm not at Tibet House so much lately just because of work, but I have an entire library of books on Buddhism here at my house, in my apartment. I wish I could read them, because I have since my accident, with all the swirling emotions, it's really hard to stay focused. So I read things a lot more slowly than I did before. Only just because I can't focus.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
But I have a lot of great books that if I could just sit down and read them, I'm sure it would help me even further. The meditation aspect of Buddhism, I know, has helped me in the past. It's really weird, though, because I don't have a daily meditation practice, and I know that would help me. So a lot of it is like, and, you know, there's, I still have elements of, you know, self-sabotage. You know, if I didn't, you know, I would meditate every day, you know, and it doesn't have to be one of these, you know, like things you see on TV, or, you know, the person sitting there and there's incense and, you know, they're going om and all that other stuff. No, I mean, you can meditate anywhere.
Right. This is why it's a practice, right? Is you know, every day is another opportunity to try again. I can totally relate, because, you know, I try and get that meditation habit, because I know that it's helpful, and I try and do it every day, but I don't succeed every day, but I try again, and I'm better and better, you know, but
yeah,
I'm trying. I'm just trying. That's all there is to it. I'm just trying.
That's all you can do.
So glad that you found Buddhism as a helpful and something that gives you some peace. So what's an example of something that you find in Buddhism that helps you?
Well, one of the things, it's probably multiple things, but there's a lot of teachings around Buddhism that teaches you that, I think the impermanence of things, that helps when you realize that when you feel like total crap, or, you know, something is happening that is absolutely horrible, or, you know, it's like there's nothing is permanent. You know, they're not saying it doesn't exist, but it's not permanent. Another thing in Buddhism that's really helped me is this idea of emptiness. And again, to people who, you know, like pop psychology, if they do pop Buddhism, they think, you know, it means that nothing exists. It's really hard to explain quickly, but emptiness is something that is something that I've been pursuing, you know, within my reading of Buddhism, that the more I read about it, the more it helps. And it basically shows you, it's a way of looking at, like, all things, you know, kind of microscopically, that they only exist as we see them. So it's a little bit of, It's like emancipating in that things that you think are causing you pain. It's not the thing that's causing you pain. It's you that's causing you pain. It's how you're thinking about it. Mm. It's how you're perceiving it. It's how you're, you know, interacting with it. So that's the greatest. I think that's the greatest thing about all the stuff in Buddhism, is that it's like, you know, you're responsible. You know, you can point the finger, but, man, you know, it's all on you. It's all how you perceive it. It's all how you, you know, everything. It's how you deal with reality.
Right.
So I think that's probably the, you know, those two aspects have helped me the most.
Yeah. I heard somebody say somewhere, I can't remember who it was, I have trouble remembering stuff like that. They said, you know, you're arguing with what is.
Oh, yeah.
I sort of, yeah, I kind of was, oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
So let's sort of reframe a little bit.
Yeah.
And look at, you know, how I'm perceiving what is. And
yeah.
I think you make a really good point. When you think about people's pain or their injuries, you know, everybody experiences their own circumstance differently. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's one reason why I'm doing this podcast, you know, hearing different people's stories and the way they've found their own path to trying to deal with their own circumstance helps me to look at things differently. And it kind of opens my brain to say, oh, my God, you know, I hadn't thought of reading about Buddhism. Maybe I should think about it that way. Maybe I should go. Could be a good thing.
It's I don't know. It's been, I mean, I don't know if I would have made it through all the trials that I've been through with, you know, since my accident without it. It's been very, very, you know, solid for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like it's been a foundation for you.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's, I mean, I'm not trying to push religion on my kids, but one of the things in Buddhism is mindfulness.
Yeah.
And, you know, and which is, you know, Buddhism has many awesome aspects, but mindfulness is one of them. And I'm really trying to teach my, you know, push mindfulness for my kids, because I feel like mindfulness is a very, very huge basic thing that if people had mindfulness, they would, this world would be very different.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really trying to teach my kids mindfulness.
Tell me just a little bit, just so we're clear about what mindfulness is, if somebody listening doesn't understand, doesn't know about mindfulness.
I guess my definition of mindfulness is taking into consideration your actions and your how you affect other people and other things.
Mm-hmm.
How you affect, you know, everything else outside of you, but also being mindfulness of yourself too.
Right.
You know, like I was at the Children's Gap, you know, one day, and I was looking at a shirt for, you know, one of my kids, and I picked it up and I, you know, unfolded it and held it up to see, you know, to see the design, see how it looked. I was like, oh, that's nice. And then so I started to fold it to put it back. And so another customer who was there said, oh, do you work here? I said, no. And they said, oh, I saw you folding that shirt and I thought you worked here. I said, no, I'm just being polite. And they're like, oh, you know, but I mean, because that's if I don't do that, then the person who, you know, is probably making out a whole lot of money per hour has to come back behind me and clean up after me.
Right.
You know, so to me, that's like, right. You know, this is just a basic example.
Mm-hmm. But you're just being sort of aware of yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Aware of what you do, how it affects others.
Yeah. You know, I think that's something that I think that we're clear about when our kids are little.
Yeah.
You know, when we're trying to be more protective, you know, don't touch that because it's hot. But then when they get to be, you know, in middle school or something, in high school, we sort of forget to teach them those things because they already know, but they don't. That's when they completely forget, you know. I think mindfulness is a wonderful thing because that's exactly when they forget the impact that they have on others.
Yeah.
So this is fantastic. You have such a brilliant story. And you've told it so beautifully. Is there anything that I've forgotten to ask you about, or that you'd like to add?
Not that I can think of. Yeah, I can't really think of anything.